This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Gregory Allen Williams, rescued two people from their attackers during the riots that followed the Rodney King verdict. In his new memoir, A Gathering of Heroes, Allen Williams writes about why he intervened and how, as an African American, it affected his thoughts on race in America. Gregory Allen Williams is an actor, a star of the popular series Baywatch, and he played a Secret Service agent in the Line of Fire. He was on his way home from the gym when he heard that a truck driver had been attacked at the intersection of Florence and Normandy. So he drove there, hoping to be one of the people that could quiet things down. On his way, he saw a group of teenagers chasing a man down the street. When Allen Williams hollered, "Leave him alone," the attackers ran. Then Allen Williams parked his car and walked to the intersection of Florence and Normandy, where he saw Takao Hirato, a Japanese-American man, being beaten unconscious in his car.
A brown Ford Bronco had pulled to a stop, and when the light changed, began moving through the intersection. As it did so, projectiles came from every corner and broke many of the windows. Several people dashed out from the corners and began beating the driver inside his vehicle. Within a few seconds, the driver slumped forward unconscious and was driven backwards by a blow to the head. At that point, I moved from the southwest corner and out to the vehicle and stepped up to the car, and there was a fellow who was about to hit him with a bottle, and I said, "Come on, y'all know this ain't right." And the young man who had the bottle, just for a moment, the bottle dropped to his side, and that gave me sort of enough time to slip in between that fellow and another fellow who had begun opening the door, I assume, so they could pull Mr. Hirata from the vehicle. But I stepped in front of them and grabbed an unconscious Takao Hirata and pulled him out of the vehicle. But even as I did so, someone struck him from the passenger side, and once we were, two or three yards from the vehicle, someone else smashed a bottle across his face.
You thought that was a really cowardly act, to smash a bottle across the face of a man who's already unconscious.
I did. It made me very angry, particularly in the wake of the riots, having been called an uprising, a revolution. I didn't think that that was a way of a warrior, an avenger of the race, to run up and strike a man who was unconscious and unable to defend himself.
Once you got Mr. Hirato out of his car, you had to figure out how to get him away from the intersection. How did you get him out?
Pulled him to the sidewalk and asked him if he could walk, and he shook his head no, and I took that. I didn't know at the time that he was delirious and really hadn't understood what I said, but I told him, "You're going to have to walk or you're going to die." He looked at me, and I began pulling him to his feet, and he put his feet under him, and we got him to his feet, and we began moving down the sidewalk, and we moved a couple of blocks, and he would lose consciousness now and then. Finally, an African-American man in a van came along and took him to Metropolitan Medical Center in downtown Los Angeles.
Well, I want to hear more about the personal reasons why you did what you did. In your book, for instance, you write about how you understood a lot about the rage that was being expressed on the streets after the Rodney King verdict, because you grew up really angry yourself.
Yeah, I had an attitude, a lot of attitude. I understand what it is to be overlooked in America, and many peoples and individuals have been overlooked for various reasons. I know what it is to wall yourself off from other people to lessen the pain. Anger at a very early age, at about 8 years old, became my friend. It was a comfort to me.
What was the anger coming from?
Well, from one growing up in a predominantly, in a Eurocentric community, in a Eurocentric school system, in Iowa, not with bad people, but with people who focused on their own culture and their own offspring, as well as people do. Of course, I came up in a time when I was told that my rage was justifiable and healthy. I remember not only in the African-American community, but in the European-American community, I can remember well, quote-unquote, liberal white people interviewing Huey and Bobby and saying, "Tell us about your rage," and just shuddering with excitement and hearing about the black man's rage. And so I came up believing that it was my birthright and a requisite to revolution and social change.
So you understood rage, and you also felt that you understood what it was like to be beaten up and what it was like to be an attacker. That you understood both parts of that.
I understood what it was to be a perpetrator of violence. I understood what it was to be a victim of violence. I understood what it was to be a bystander.
When were you a victim?
There was an incident in seventh grade when I had transferred to a predominantly white junior high school because I wasn't an athlete. I had been going to a predominantly black junior high, and I wasn't an athlete and that sort of thing. And in my neighborhood, if you weren't an athlete, if you were a musician and writer, whatnot, then you weren't hip, you weren't cool, you weren't really black. So I said, well, I'll go over and be with the white folks because they're reasonable and civilized. So I went. And after a few months there, I was coming out of band practice one day in the auditorium, and a high schooler from a school about 10 miles away, huge guy, hit me at the auditorium door. Just as I got to the door, I didn't even see it coming, and he shattered my lip. And many of my fellow students laughed, and I was stumbling around, bleeding from the mouth, and that sort of thing. And when I was suspended from school, and
you were suspended.
I was suspended from school. And a couple of days later, when my mother and I came to school, the vice principal told my mother that I had come to that school walking too tall and holding my head a little too high, and the other students resented it. Therefore, what could I expect? That was really what moved me forward to help Mr. Harada. It was the memory of that pain, not the physical pain, but I think I describe it as the pain of knowing what it is to be exiled from the human heart, to be set upon, to be innocent, and to be surrounded by people who don't care, who have banished you, exiled you.
But you also knew what it was like to be a part of a small mob attacking
yes.
somebody else. When were you the attacker?
In the United States Marine Corps during boot camp, there was a private named Ledoux who we termed a non-hacker, who the drill instructors termed a non-hacker. He fell out of the runs in the morning. He didn't shine his brass or his boots very well. His personal hygiene was lacking. And when he would screw up, we would all be punished. So one night we rose 3 or 4 in the morning, threw blankets over him, and began beating him. I, too, fell out of the morning run. It took me a good while to learn to shine my shoes, but I was a coward who was trying to become a man and a hero by being a Marine in the first place. I didn't dislike LaRue, but I didn't have the courage to stop and not participate and to tell others not to participate. So lest I be found out that I perhaps was a non-hacker, that I wasn't really one of the few, the proud, I willingly joined others in this violent action that drove this young recruit to attempt suicide the following day.
So these are some of the reasons why you intervened, because you felt you had some kind of understanding about rage, about violence, about being attacked, about being an attacker.
Yes.
You were asked to testify at the Reginald Denny trial. What was your function in the trial?
Well, Takao doesn't remember anything, so I'm sort of his memory of the incident. So I was there to corroborate what had happened to him. I had told the prosecutors that I didn't remember any faces, so I couldn't make any IDs of anyone. What I really suspect is that they were playing a good nigger, bad nigger game.
Meaning?
They knew that I would come in a suit and a tie out of respect for the court, and that my hair would be trimmed, and that I wasn't wearing a beard at that time. And that what they would do is they would say, you see, this fellow helped people and he's black. This fellow seems conservative and reasonable. But look at these fellows here. They're bad people. So we're not racist by heaping these charges on all of these charges on these fellows and charges that we probably can't prove. You know what I mean? We're really being fair here. And I think that I was really part of that routine.
Were the questions you were asked that you found offensive on either side?
I didn't find any of the questions offensive. I'm not sure that I found the strategy offensive. I'm simply saying that I understand the nature of the strategy, which was one reason why I wrote A Gathering of Heroes. Because I thought it was very important that I make it very clear that if indeed I am a good nigger today, it didn't happen in an instant, that it's been a process, that indeed there was a time when I would have been among those who were attacking people at the intersection of Florence and Normandy. So the question is, how did this happen?
Now, how seriously do you think that at some time in your life you would have been one of the people attacking others?
There's no doubt in my mind. I did it once. I did it in the Marine Corps. Why wouldn't I do it again? I mean, there have been times in my life when I was so enraged at white people in general that violence was not far from my mind. And if any white person gave me any excuse, any reason, any invitation to violence, I was ready to go. It has happened on more than one occasion. Even occasionally now, a look, a word at the wrong time, even so far as attentiveness. I have a problem very often with white people feeling that I'm accessible to them. Sometimes I feel that white folks just talk to black folks that they don't know just because they feel that black folks are accessible. And there are times when I say to myself, why is it that this white person thinks that I am so accessible to them? They can just begin speaking to me and engage me in a conversation. Would they do the same thing to a white person? Do they feel that I am less than they are? So I can just sort of, they can engage me however they choose to engage me. It's very sick, and I have to guard against it. But even now, though it doesn't turn to violence, there is violence inside of me.
Explain more about this feeling people assume you're accessible. White people assume you're accessible because you're black. Explain that to me.
There are times when, for example, on public transportation, and on public transportation, we all know that you look at the signs and you don't look at each other and you don't talk to people that you don't know. And so you're standing there and this white guy starts to talk to you about not really intimate things, but sort of personal things. And you say, my goodness, what is it about me that makes you think that you can break the rule of anonymity and silence on this train? And it may simply be because you have a friendly face for very positive reasons. But sometimes my old thinking says to me, oh, he wouldn't speak to a white person because he respects them enough to respect their walls, their parameters.
If you had the chance to, like, actually talk to the people who were attacking the people who you saved, what would you want to say to them?
Those who have been convicted, I would say, don't you see? The truth is, Reginald Denny, Takao Harata, and so many others are about to sue the city for millions of dollars. As they say in the neighborhood, they're going to get paid. You sitting in the jail where so many have gone before. You tell me about the unfairness of the criminal justice system, and indeed, I understand that. But what role have you played in your own banishment? Did you relinquish control over your life by your action? And we can talk all day about poverty and not having a daddy at home and all of that sort of thing. But you may not be responsible for the problem, but you must be responsible for the solution, because it is your death and your exile that we're dealing with here.
My guest is actor Gregory Allen Williams. His new memoir, A Gathering of Heroes, is about how and why he rescued two people during the L.A. riots. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Gregory Allen Williams. Does this whole experience of having rescued a couple of people during the rioting and having to testify at the Reginald Denny trial, becoming pretty well known, at least in Los Angeles, for what you did, has that, like, set you on a different course in any way?
Frighteningly so. It has. For a long time, as being a theater actor for many years and working in Chicago and Minneapolis and then, getting a few films and finally getting a television series, I thought, oh, this is going to do me. This is going to do it. And I find that that fantasy is so unfulfilling. And along the way, I've always dealt in the real world, primarily with my writing. And I found that now, you know, people say, well, will you come and talk to us about your actions at Florence and Normandy and about your feelings? And so on one hand, people are calling me and asking me to come and pretend to be someone else as an actor. And then people are asking me to come and to share and to learn as Gregory. The two right now are in conflict. I've had to turn down many acting jobs. My agent has dumped me. You know, people are saying, what are you doing? L.A. Law wants to check you, just checking your availability. Why are you in this high school in Harlem? You know, and there are moments when I have to ask myself that question. But as much as I love being an actor and as much as that brings me, I have to do something with it. And so when I go into a school and 10th or 11th graders say, oh, you're the man from Baywatch, and they listen to me for 60 seconds because of that, and within that 60 seconds, they're judging whether or not we have something to talk about. And if I do, now we've got a dialogue. Now we can talk about real things. And what happens most often is when we're done after an hour and a half, 2 hours, there are no questions about Baywatch. Now we're talking about issues of violence, issues of survival, compassion, justice, and liberty. That, ultimately, is much more rewarding than playing a make-believe character, I don't care how redeeming, on television. And that certainly affects my career and certainly affects my bank account. But, you know, that's what time it is.
I'll confess that I haven't seen Baywatch because it's on in the day and they don't let me watch TV during the day. But I know it's real popular. And isn't it like an afternoon soap with a lot of babes on it?
In some places it airs in prime time.
Oh, really?
In the evening. It is. It's Southern California lifeguards on the beach. I play a police officer. And I tell you, it's a funny thing because even in the industry, people want me to be ashamed of it. My agent says, don't put it on your resume. Don't put it on your reel. The other day we got a call from a producer wanted me to come to audition, wanted me to send a reel of my work. And he said, but don't put any Baywatch on it because it's babes on the beach. Well, I'm not a babe on the beach. And they certainly didn't hire me for my breast or my buns. I am on that show an acting anchor. And my work is good, and the writers write good stuff for me. And there have been times when I did hide my Baywatch involvement, but I don't anymore because I have nothing to be ashamed of, and my work is quality work. And
you're a cop on the show.
Yeah, and it takes a lot. You know, I get up sometimes at 5, 6 in the morning, and I get to go to the beach, and I'm out on the beach in the morning at 6 a.m., and the gulls are flying, and it's beautiful. You know, and then I'm in, you know, New York, or I'm in Boston, and I'm in schools, and I'm listening to children tell me that they're going to be dead in 3 or 4 years because they've bought the statistics, you know, and these are children who are scholastically superior, telling me, well, you're going to be dead in 3 and 4 years, in 3 or 4 years. It's a good balance. And everybody's life needs balance. So I go on Baywatch and I do some light comedy and sometimes some drama. And I ride this little quad around and sometimes a horse, you know, and then I go out into the real world. And it helps me to do that.
Speaking of acting, you were in The Line of Fire with Clint Eastwood. What parts did you play in that?
I played a Secret Service agent whose name I have forgotten and probably most of the audience has. I spent 9 weeks on, matter of fact, I wrote most of the book on the set of In the Line of Fire. Would bring my word processor.
Oh, wrote most
every
of your book, A Gathering of Heroes.
Yeah, between takes, and people would say, you bring that thing every day, what are you writing? And I'd say, well, I'm just catching up on my correspondence. Because, you know, when you're an actor in Hollywood, that's what you are, and you certainly don't tell anyone you're trying to write, because then you open yourself up to smirks and, oh, there's an actor trying to write. They hired me as an actor. You know, and I would go and do my scenes, and I'd go back to my dressing room and, you know, work on the book and go home.
I want to ask you another question about race. I mean, I think a lot of African Americans feel, and I'm in no position to speak for African Americans being white, but I've certainly heard this expressed enough, and it's a sentiment I understand, that Other ethnic groups came here to get ahead. They were fleeing from something, whereas African Americans were brought here on slave ships. They didn't ask to come, and it's been, I mean, there's been just obstacles galore toward achieving any kind of success in the United States. And I think African Americans can legitimately say that they're just in a, they came here in a completely different context, and it's changed everything.
Yes, others brought their culture, they brought their language, they brought something to cling to. African Americans were stripped of their culture, stripped of their language. When people say things to me like, why don't you like those Vietnamese immigrants who came here only 10 years ago and now own restaurants and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, what have we had to battle against and continue to have to battle against, particularly ourselves? It is a miracle. It is amazing. There is so much more to do. But when you think about it, such a short time. My great-grandfather told my grandmother and her siblings, you can choose one of two names, Ross or Cockroth. The first man to own me was Ross. The last man to own me was Cockroth. I am a miracle. And this is a miracle. And there are many more miracles to be performed. So when people want to say, well, you black folks need to get it together, I say, back off. And then I turn around and I say to my African-American brothers and sisters, yeah, there's been some miracles, but now we've got to sort of turn inward and look and mourn. We have never mourned monuments to dead soldiers in Vietnam, the Second World War. Not one monument to the 5,800 African-American men who were drugged from their homes and beaten and burned between the late 1800s and the 1950s. We do not mourn. We have never mourned. Let us come together. Let us mourn and let us move forward. Let us face ourselves and face our own failings and stop looking outside of ourselves for all of our demons.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Gregory Allen Williams, his new memoir is called A Gathering of Heroes. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.